You want to know who Donald Trump competed with long before he became president? Meet this week's Game Face exec, Mike Kaiser, the patron saint of public golf. In this episode, you'll hear a rare interview with a man who built and sold one of the top greeting card companies in America, then used his wealth to pursue his passion, lots of people's passion actually, developing six of Golf Week magazine's top 60 modern-day courses in the U.S. But don't worry if golf's not your thing. This interview fills anyone's bag with lessons from an influencer who hasn't lost his humility and grace. Mike Kaiser, golf's game changer.
And I am so thrilled to have my friend, which is a label that I'm grateful for, my friend and someone that I've looked up to for a long time. And I've been fortunate enough to have association with him, both publicly and privately, Mike Kaiser, who's joined us today on Game Face Execs, a name that is very, very well known throughout the golf world and, in fact, throughout the sports world for his innovation, his creativity. He is truly a transformer and really a game changer. So, Mike, thanks for joining us.
Nice to be with you today, Rob.
And Mike is... been kind enough to join us from his home, and so we're grateful for that. Mike, you know, you and I have had an association for, it's probably going on 10 years now. Yeah, it's about 10 years. I'm a little older, but you're still as young as ever. But I want to take the listener back to when you and I first met and talk a little bit about the conditions that brought us together. It was a pleasure to meet you that first time under the conditions that we did. That was back in the state of Oregon, and where I used to be based. Our company, Game Face, was based in the Portland area, and I raised my family in the Oregon community. And I was serving on a particular board that had a plot of land on the Oregon coast. And you're very familiar with the Oregon coast, and we'll talk about that here. But that plot of land had was of particular interest to you. Could you tell a little bit about how that story unfolded?
I assume it's okay to mention that the owner of the big parcel of land was Camp Meriwether, which is a Boy Scout summer camp. And they had a big section of land right on the ocean that... for various reasons, they never used. They used areas north and south and, I guess, east of it, but never this big parcel. So Rob and Matt's idea was if that became a golf course, it would make money to increase the operations and day-to-day outreach of Cub Scouts. So they called me to basically sell me on this site, and it was their salesmanship plus visiting the site, which is magnificent. It had about a half a mile of ocean frontage in the northern Oregon coast. So I immediately saw that their plan was a good plan and spent a lot of time and some money trying to figure out how we would fit 18 holes. It's called a routing on this great site. And sadly, we had a great routing, but it included 2 to 3 holes on what turned out to be wetlands, and we didn't have enough space to move it. So what went from a very exciting fundraising project for the Boy Scouts of America became not a failure, but we just couldn't make 18 holes work. It's big enough for 15 holes, but not 18 holes. And my judgment was that 15 holes wouldn't do it.
And I want to give credit also to Tim Boyle, who is the CEO and chairman of Columbia Sportswear. I think you were golfing with him at some point. Maybe it was in Oregon. I don't know where it was. But Tim, who has always been a great supporter of Boy Scouts of America, at least in the Northwest, he was actually the one that thought of introducing you to me. I was chairman of that board, as you said. And Matt DeVore, who is the chief scout, the CEO of the scouting organization in that area. Tim introduced us, and I think we had a good year and a half run at it, didn't we, Mike?
Yeah. It was almost to the point. We'd hired a golf course architect, Bill Coore and Ben Crenshaw. They were excited. and everyone is crestfallen to find that, unbeknownst to us, right in the middle of this beautiful site was a wetland, and you can't move wetlands, so that did us in.
Well, as we walked that site, that was a very unique experience, and I would just say to my listeners, who are a lot of them are fans of yours, Mike Kaiser, if they had the opportunity to walk a course with you as I did, they would learn so much, not only about the game of golf, but about the vision that a developer, a talented developer like you, brings to the game, and how you, in fact, embellish the game in a good way because of that vision. So your connection, though, to Oregon started in the mid-1990s.
It started even more than I began buying property in the late 80s.
Oh, okay.
And didn't open Bandon Dunes, the first of now five golf courses, until May 1st, 1999. So you're right. My real involvement with Oregon and the Oregon coast started in 1999, but I started buying land for it in the late 80s, as I said.
Well, you gave me the privilege of walking those five courses at Bandon Dunes with you as we were contemplating a transaction up on the northern coast of Oregon, as you've described. You said, let's go down to Bandon and let's walk those courses together, and I'll show you how I put together these types of courses. And that was, of course, for me, a once-in-a-lifetime experience to walk Bandon Dunes with Mike Kaiser. And I want the listeners to know,
I'm glad you had fun, Rob.
Oh, I had a ball. But I got to tell you, I was pretty tired at the end of the day because you insisted on walking the whole thing. Now,
it's a walking sport.
Well, talk a little bit about that, Mike, because when I pass golf courses in my travels and even in the area where I now live, so many people are in carts. And obviously some people are unable to walk, but they may have some limitations physically. But you always walk courses. Could you tell us a little bit about how that began for you, or is that just for you, the natural way of golfing?
That is the natural way of golfing. It all starts in Scotland back in the 15th century. Before Columbus discovered America, Scotsmen, usually sheepherders, were playing golf in the dunes in the Lynx land of northern Scotland. And, of course, there were no carts. And, of course, they walked with their shepherd's crook hitting stones into small holes and crevasses. That's how golf started, and that's how golf has continued to this day in Scotland and Ireland and England. I would include England as well, where golf is a walking sport. America, post-World War II, discovered the electric and gas-powered golf carts and married that into the game of golf as played in America. But that was a decidedly contrarian choice that American golf made to leave walking only Scotland, Ireland, England, going one way, which was to preserve its golf as it was meant to be, walking only nature, and introduce golf carts to golf, which in my opinion has harmed golf ever since World War II, when they began building golf cart courses. A handful of private clubs that have been walking only ever since World War II. Most caved in to the pressure of the golf cart makers. And with the promise of making more money for the pro shops, club after club, facility after facility went to the electric golf cart, the bane of existence for those who believe that Scotland knows how to play golf.
Well, and on those courses that you just described, they're known as links courses. For those listeners who aren't as familiar with the game of golf, and I know that may sound sacrilegious to you, that someone would not be as familiar with it as anyone else, but talk about links courses and what attracts you to that type of course, because it is so unforgiving and sometimes relentless to golf on such a course as that.
So links land is what the Scottish shepherds found in northern Scotland way back when. It was land that linked the beach, which, of course, is not arable and is worthless for agriculture, Lynxland linked the beach with arable pasture land. It was the land between the beach and pasture land. It was so poor in quality that nothing agricultural was done on it back in the 15th, 16th, 17th, 18th century, that it was simply referred to as the common area, the Lynx land, and because no one owned it, the shepherds could roam around it and basically make a game of it, which they did. The interesting thing about Bandon Dunes is we found what I would call Lynx land, beautiful dunes with very minimal agricultural characteristics, and because no one wanted it, I was able to buy it for a very small amount of money and develop the Bandon Dunes Golf Resort on what became 3,000 acres of agriculturally worthless Lynx land, just like Scotland.
Well, I remember when we walked the course up on the northern coast of Oregon, on that land that the scouts own, you kept saying to us repeatedly, there has to be sand here. There has to be sand. If there's no sand, I can't build the course that I want. And so that, along with the natural terrain, made me constantly think about, this man likes difficult golf, right? I mean, I typically, because I'm not a very good golfer, Mike, I want as easy a course as I can get, but I think there's some life lessons for young people, for professionals, about tackling the difficult, right? Doing the hard things. And maybe you have some thoughts about that, how the natural terrain of Lynx is kind of like life. It's kind of like business.
It kind of is. I would refute your statement that it's more difficult. Just the fact that it's built on sand dunes doesn't make it more difficult. What makes it more difficult are the windy days, because it's coastal, whether it's Scotland, Ireland, or Oregon. There are days on the coast when the wind whips up. And the lesson for everyone is, when there's no wind, the Scotsmen say, when there's no wind, there's no golf, which is to say the golf is a lot easier when there's no wind. And when there is wind, deal with it. So in that way, your observation was correct. Maybe we walked it on a windy day, and you concluded rightly that playing in a 30-mile-an-hour wind makes golf very challenging. Some people rise to the occasion. Others cave in and say, oh, it's too windy.
Well, could I surmise then that good golfers on a Lynx course, on a windy course, they not only require skill, but they also have to hope for some luck as well?
Yeah, or I would put it, they need to exercise creativity. An example, if you're playing a hole into a stiff 30-mile-an-hour wind, a lot of golfers hit a high ball, a high drive or a high three-wood. The really good Lynx players know that if you keep it low to the ground, it will bore through the wind rather than, in a willowy way, blowing off because it's too high. So using your creativity to come up with ways to deal with a windy golf course is part of the fun challenge of golf on Lynx courses.
You know, hearing you talk about that, Mike, it makes me think of kind of a what might be a dichotomy about the game, especially the kind of game that you enjoy and that you promote, and that is that you go back to the traditional side of golf. You bring us back the way golf was meant to be played. And yet to do that requires tremendous innovation. So to be a traditionalist doesn't mean that you're uncreative. It means that you have to be more creative in today's world than perhaps others. Am I on the right track here?
Yeah, I think I would put it this way, that before Bandon Dunes proved the popularity of Lynx golf in America, there really wasn't Scottish-Irish golf in the dunes in America. Those few that I would list are all very private clubs on the East Coast where the typical golfer can't get in or can't get there or can't get on the course. And most of America is golf cart courses or tree-lined fairways, definitely not on the ocean, and definitely not in sand dunes as they are in Scotland and Ireland. So to take that to say that's the product, which is totally different than what is being sold in America up until Bannon Dunes. Took some stalwart, I'll even say courage, to present it to the American golfer. And guess what? They liked it as much as they do Scotland and Ireland.
Well,
it's helped greatly, and I would think that your readers would enjoy hearing that it's always good to have a model. You know, if you know where you're going and it's going to look roughly like this, to have a target or a model that you're seeking. I had a model in the form of the Lynx courses of Scotland. Royal Dornick, up in the Scottish Highlands in particular, was my favorite model because it's extremely remote, just like Bannon Dunes. But every day, all summer, tour buses full of American golfers rolled in and out they went to play golf on this magnificent golf course called Royal Dornick. That was my model, figuring if tour buses would come to northern Scotland, they would probably go to southern Oregon.
Well, you talk about a model, Mike. I've always thought that you just had really an unusual vision. So are you suggesting that visions has to come from somewhere? It has to come from something?
Yes, I would. Maybe not as a cardinal rule, but in general, if you can have a model of where you want to go, you will be better served. You know, basically, it's a pathway. You're better with a pathway through the wilderness than just sort of braving it on your own. So you give me too much credit. I had a model. I played it numerous times, watched it. It was Royal Dornick.
So when I have a vision or a model of that which I'm trying to either replicate or create with my own twist, can you describe for us a little bit about how that process works, at least for you? In your successful career, seeing something is one thing, but executing on it and actually making it a reality is completely another ball game. So how does one successfully go about it, as you've done over the years?
That's a good question, Rob. But that's where, again, if you don't have a model, you just sort of flail away. I've already said I had a model, Royal Dornick. And then to make the business case for that is, I said to anyone who would listen, friends, family, business. So I said, I want to build something like Royal Dornick in the United States, and I've picked the state of Oregon as having fabulous beaches and lynx land. So I'd like to go there. And even though that's remote for most people from New York City, Atlanta, etc., I think that Royal Dornick, they will come. I made the case, which to me was worth trying, and frankly, Rob, almost no one thought it was a good idea. They all said, that's an interesting vision you have, Mike, but there's no way we'll finance it. There's no way we'll go see it. There's no way it will work. It is simply too remote. Forgetting that I just made a big point of Royal Dornick is at least as remote in the highlands of Scotland as the southern coast of Oregon. That didn't matter. It was just I was presenting a different product. My model was different than what people were used to. And because it was so different, they said, no, we won't finance it. We won't support it. We think you're crazy. So if you find yourself in that situation, you need financing to do it on your own, whether it's bank financing or private equity or venture capital or your own money. It comes down to who's going to take the risk, and usually it's the, quote, visionary who may not have this great vision but is able to come up with the funding to get it started at least.
Well, I want to share with the listeners something that David McClay Kidd said, and he was your first architect at Bannon Dunes, and I know that he has worked with you on other courses, including Sand Valley in Wisconsin. But let me just share with everyone what he said about you. He said, Mike has an ability to draw out of people much more than they thought they were capable of, or maybe more than they were capable of. So I respect the fact that you have to get finance and you have to go sell the bank or the private equity firm or what have you. And so whether it's the financiers or whether it is an architect who perhaps has never been to the state of Oregon, doesn't even know how to find it, or your family and friends, how do you go about communicating, Mike? How do you draw out of people their either that which is dormant in them or which they don't even have right now, but through your communication, your expression of vision, they want to follow you?
So the only thing I can lay claim to was knowing that American golf architects were by and large illiterate when it came to links golf. So early on, I decided I wouldn't try to convince Pete Dye or Tom Fazio or Jack Nicklaus what a links course is. I decided to use someone who knew links courses, and there are not many people in the world at the time who knew much about links courses, and up came David Kidd and his father Jimmy, and they said, "We've heard you want to build a links course, and we don't think it's that crazy. We worked at Glen Eagles Golf Resort in Scotland. We summer every year at Macrahanish. We know what a links course is. We are your man." And I hired them as let's call them visionaries to join me, because there was no one else who knew enough about golf to do it, and it turned out they were brilliant. I don't think they knew at the time what a good site it was, and they certainly didn't know what a good job they would do with input from me and others as they developed it.
Well, one thing about you, Mike, that unless someone has met you or perhaps watched an interview with you, they wouldn't know. But Mike Kaiser is not a bombastic, fiery, pound-on-the-desk type of leader. If you'll excuse the description, you're a gentle giant in our industry. Your demeanor, when I first met you in the last 10 years that I've known you, has always been, to me, one of your greatest qualities. And so I'm hearing from you that persuasion and influencing of another person or parties is not about being the most vociferous person perhaps in the room, or the person who just basically is getting people to submit to your will. There has to be some gentle persuasion along the way. Now, has that always been your nature, or have you learned that's the best way to operate your business?
I would say it's always been part of the atmosphere, because we got my three brothers and I picked that up from my dad, who was above all else modest. He was a World War II Navy pilot, war hero. He won the Navy Cross. Never bragged about it, never even talked about it. We learned from him that you don't talk about your accomplishments. You prove yourself by doing them and let others talk about their success. You never tout and you never engage in braggadocio and loudness. You let others you lead the way and let others notice that it's a good path. So I owe all of that to my dad. And I think you're right to pick that out as a characteristic of great leadership or even good leadership. Modesty is a big factor.
It seems so much in short supply today. We're in a culture, in a business culture, where it seems like we are encouraged to constantly toot our horn, whether it's through social media or other type of media. It's about, look at me, see what I've done, see what I'm eating for lunch today. Aren't I great? So is that difficult for you to watch, or do you not pay much attention to that type of personality, Mike?
I basically ignore that kind of personality. So I pretty much, Rob, try to ignore those people who are bombastic and egotistical and me. And I keep noticing that so many successful business people are very low key. And even when they talk about themselves, and I'm thinking of Charles Schwab, who grew up modest and is a great golfer, having been a caddy. I would use him as an example of, you can even talk about my vision, because he does, in talking about Charles Schwab and why it makes sense to work with him. Even when he's talking about himself, he does so in a modest, I'll let our accomplishments speak louder than egotistical statements. So there are a lot of people who follow your correct dictum that keep a low profile and that your deeds speak for you.
Well, I think that is a struggle that I'm going to say today's generation of business leaders or up-and-coming business leaders probably have, because, as I said, in this world of social media and everyone knows what everyone else is doing seems 24/7, it's very much almost a voyeuristic world that we live in. And so that the persona that you carry and that style that you're known for is refreshing. And I don't want to say it's old school. I wish it would become more prevalent today.
Yeah, I do too. I think it is old school. It's sort of I don't know where my dad got it, but I know he felt that Rockefeller was much maligned for the wrong reasons, that he was very church-going. I know my dad used Rockefeller as an example of dutiful tithing, and that was part of the old school, that you saved 10% of what you made, and you, of course, gave at least 10% away to those who were needy. It's sort of part and parcel to that old-fashioned lead by example, not by your mouth.
You know, you and I have spent a lot of time together when you have talked about your father. And he first came up because we met because of our mutual affiliation with the Boy Scouts of America. And so your father was a big scouter, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, you're right to recollect. Thank you. He was an Eagle Scout and was dismayed when his sons, led by me, I was the oldest son, did not follow him into, we just began Boy Scouts, but we didn't have the gumption, Rob, to go ahead and get our Eagle Scout badge.
Well, that was one of many
disappointments.
I'm like you, Mike. I joined scouting as a youth. I did not finish it, so to speak, but I do have three sons, and I'm proud to say that all three of them became Eagle Scouts.
Good going, Rob. They must have had a good dad.
No. Mike, you know, they have a good mom, right? That's the key to get an Eagle Scout.
Good going. 3 for 3 is pretty good.
Mike, about your youth, you were a caddy when you were young, and being a golf caddy taught you a lot of important lessons that you have since passed on to younger generations through providing caddy opportunities for them. We'd love to hear more about how being a golf caddy shaped your character, and also why you feel it's so important that young people perhaps look into that, and how you've created avenues for them to, in fact, take advantage of those opportunities.
So, Rob, caddying is all about making money while carrying a bag. And everyone who caddies, especially young people, and I started caddying when I was 10, 11, my fruitful years were 10 through 14. So at ages 10 through 14, all young people have no idea about their abilities and quickly learn that in caddying, you're basically selling yourself. The proposition is this: I'm assigned to someone like Rob for 18 holes, but the only way I can get Rob to reuse me the next time he plays golf is to do a good job. And kids, both sales guys and not sales guys, have to learn that, or they're the ones who no one ever chooses to be a caddy. So that basic, here I am, I'm 10, I'm going to be with this adult who I've never met for 4 hours. How do I get that adult to say, are you available on Thursday? Because I'd like you to caddy for me again. That was the sales proposition for all these young people at Easter or a country club and every other club throughout the world who caddy at an early age. It's basically about selling yourself.
Well, and thus your disdain for golf carts, because it's difficult to use a caddy when you've got a cart instead, isn't it?
Yes, it is.
Well, and I think about the time spent between a young boy or young girl and that golfer, and the the minimal but impactful mentoring that can take place during that time.
Yeah.
I'm sure you have seen golfers who lend good advice to caddies, and it's almost free advice. In fact, the caddy's getting paid to take that advice, and to have that one-on-one is a remarkable experience.
My worst experience caddying was my best learning experience. Finally, when I was, let's say, 12, the champion of East Aurora Country Club, Bud Dow, D-O-W, decided he would use me. He'd heard good things from other people. He said, okay, Mike, I've never used you before. You can caddy for me. We sort of took 8 holes to get used to each other. And on hole number 9, he, for the first time, said, okay, Mike, you've been watching me. What should I hit? And he was 150 yards from the 9th green after his very good drive. And I had no idea. I knew that I should have an idea because I'd been with him for 8 holes, but I had no real good idea what Bud Dow should hit from 150 yards. So I said, well, I think a 4 or 5 iron. And I said that because that's what I would have hit. So I answered as what I would hit was a 4 or 5 iron. Bud looked at me and said, give me the 8. And he hit an 8 iron 8 feet away and never used me as a caddy again. And his advice after he hit his 8 iron to the green was, it works in all situations to this day. If you don't know, don't guess. And I've asked that of employees throughout my business career. One of the great signs of a good employee and a future good manager is when you don't know, ask. Don't guess. Bud Dow taught me that with 1 8-iron.
That's a great story. So many applications in all aspects of life.
Yeah, if you don't know, don't guess. Because that's the tendency for most people. They say, well, let's see, I guess a 4 iron, because that's what I would hit. No, I'm not you. I'm Bud Dow. I'm the champion. I hit it a lot farther, and you should have known that. And if you didn't know that, you should have turned it back to me and said, I just don't know.
Wow. My grandfather, Mike, who lived to be almost 102 years old, said to me that the 3 most powerful words in business sometimes are simply, I don't know.
Yeah, very well said. I call it cardinal rule number 1. I don't. Your willingness to say, I don't know.
So those caddies, that position of being a caddy, obviously had a great impact on your life. And as I mentioned a moment ago, you've created opportunities for more young people to have that experience. Can you share with the audience a little bit about how you've made that a reality for so many kids?
It's as simple as having a golf course, or now 5 golf courses in Bandon and other courses elsewhere, as I've already said, we don't have carts. We have walking only, and we have, because most of our golfers are eager not to carry their own bag but to employ someone, we have tens of thousands per year rounds that need caddies. So we at Bandon Dunes, we have 350 caddies, many of whom are kids, many of whom win scholarships to go to college, as it's called the Chick Evans Scholarship Foundation. And at any one time, there are 1,200 kids in college with full ride.
That's wonderful. Mike, we talked about Bandon. I want to get into a little bit of the granularity of how that project became a reality, because, as I say, I'm a native Oregonian, and as one who grew up in the northern part of the state, in the Portland area, Coos Bay, which is, you know, the largest semi-big city close to Bandon Dunes. Growing up, nobody went to Coos Bay. You only went there if you were raised there. It was not a destination spot. So granted, in the 90s, late 80s and 90s, I was no longer a child, but I can understand people's perhaps puzzlement and dismay when they heard from you that you wanted to go to that part of Oregon and build a world-famous golf resort. there had to be pushback even locally as well, because you were a disruptor. You had, I'm sure, some opposition, as you and I experienced in Northern Oregon when we tried to drive that project on that scouting property. So can you share with us a little bit more about the opposition that you faced and what it took to overcome it?
So there are two types of opposition. The harder to overcome were the environmentalists saying, this is precious, even though no one even knows it's there. This is too precious to build a golf course. You can't. So there's the environmental pushback, which was significant and took 3.5 years, where my partner at the time and master architect Howard McKee to reason and sort of horse trade with the environmental group. It took 3.5 years to get their approval. The other source of negativity were all the locals who just sort of shook their head and said, well, you know, if you want to do a foolish thing, Mike, just go out there and spend $15 million building a golf course, because no one ever comes here to Bannon, much less to play golf. And, you know, it's windy, and I don't know who would come. Remember, with that group, I'd already passed that bridge with the model of Royal Dornick, so none of them had ever heard of Royal Dornick. And the best I could get from them is, I think you're wrong. I think there are enough examples in Scotland and Ireland that people will drive 10 hours from San Francisco or 5 hours from Portland to play a Lynx golf course. And they just shook their heads and basically said in their body language, you have to be an idiot if you think that's true. So the environmentalists were a harder opposition group, but I'd say the casual naysayers who were all over the board in terms of friends, financiers, bankers, etc., were uniform in their skepticism that it made any sense whatsoever. So in a way, they were bigger critics than the environmental groups.
Well, Mike, every business person, every salesperson faces opposition, objections, as we call it. You can either walk away and say, this is just too hard. The objections are too great, too high. That hurdle is too high to get over. Or you can patiently work through it, and you obviously did the latter. So was your appetite and was your desire to build this course because you knew it was a moneymaker, or because you knew that it would be the preeminent course in the United States, and some might argue broader than that? Or what was it that continued to drive you forward to work with these individuals, and how did you work with them?
So, Rob, this is not your perfect answer, but it is true. I went forward because I had the money in hand, which I could lose without going bankrupt, to build the resort. Mm-hmm. Had I been dependent on other financial sources, I don't think I could have gotten a bank, even if I had put up, assume that I have no money. So I couldn't have gotten a bank to lend even 80% of the project, because I'm sure I could have reluctantly raised from reluctant friends the sort of the downstroke. But I know that I have a number of banker friends, and they say there's no way we would have lent you a dime on your project, no matter what your equity stake was. It was just too dumb. So the only reason I went forward is I actually had the money from the sale of our greeting card company 3 years earlier. And if it hadn't been for that, it never would have gotten built. So in that case, the lesson would be past success finances the next vision, which had no
Absolutely.
Certainty about succeeding.
Absolutely. Well, now I will say to our listeners, Mike Kaiser is a saint in Southern Oregon, because what you have done for that community, not just the economic impact, which is perhaps immeasurable, but also you've given people opportunities there. You've given them jobs. You've sustained families. And you've put it on the map. There's no question about it. People come from all over the world and drive for how many hours from the Portland International Airport?
4.5 to 5, depending on how fast you drive.
Yeah. So And I got to tell a story, Mike. If you'll allow me, I just want to share a brief story with the audience, and I think you'll remember this. When you and I walked that course, or the five courses of Bandon Dunes, which, again, was a once-in-a-lifetime experience to be able to do that with you and to hear your description of why you did the things that you did there and the obstacles, not only the community obstacles, but also just the geographic obstacles and the terrains, et cetera. We were finally at the end of the day. I was exhausted. You were fine. But finally, we were picked up by someone in a van from the lodge, from the resort. And it was one of your new employees. And you and I had been wearing, along with Matt DeVore, the three of us, we were wearing baseball caps and sunglasses most of the day because it was a blistery Oregon day. And as this young man picked us up in the van and began to take us back to the resort, I struck up a conversation with him, and I said, "So how long have you worked here at Bandon Dunes?" He said, "I just started 2 weeks ago." I said, "Oh, I bet you're really feeling lucky to get a job like this." He says, "Oh, you wouldn't believe how fortunate I feel. This is a great place to work." And he says, "It's such an honor to be able to drive Mr. Kaiser back to the resort right now. In fact, everyone's jealous of me back at the resort that I get to drive Mr. Kaiser and you, and also you." And I thought, what's he talking about? Why would he be talking that it's a pleasure to drive me? And he says, "Well, it's a pleasure to drive you as well, Mr. Wahlberg." So, because I was somewhat in disguise that day, he thought that you had a better, more impressive guest with you. So,
yeah, interesting. Mark Wahlberg is a very good golfer. I've played with him.
Well, obviously you've played with him. Why would they think that I would be him?
I don't know.
So I want to ask you, too, about the fact that you have a family business. You have brought your sons into your work. I know they are accomplished developers and designers themselves. And I've met your sons, and just like you, they've inherited that DNA of gentlemanness and dignity. But a lot of people listening right now probably have been in family-run businesses or contemplating bringing their sons or daughters into a business or joining mom or dad in the business. And many times that fails. That just doesn't work out. Why did you make that decision, or how did you allow that to happen, and why is it working so well for you and the Kaiser family?
So my older son is Michael. My younger son is Chris. Michael expressed, they both are avid golfers. They both had been to Bandon Dunes before they were employee age. But when Michael was in college, he expressed some interest in going to Bandon and working in the summer. And I said, "Yeah, I think we can do that, Mike, but I need you to know this. If you go there, you're going to get the job that is least desirable, the one at the bottom, and you're going to raise your hand and say, 'I want that job that no one else wants to do.' You're going to arrive always early. To be on time is not to be on time. It's to be on time, you really need to be at least 15 minutes early. And I want you to continue to always be open to tasks that no one else wants to do." So he started at the bottom out there and sort of stayed there for the first 2 years, raised his hand and did a number of customer-oriented things that enriched his experience and helped the guests, and basically started at the bottom. In observing other families, they so often start their kids at the executive level with no experience managing people or doing things on their own. And I would say my son Michael, with many others examples, paved the way because he was willing to do the jobs that no one wanted to do.
And so over time, obviously, he learned the skills necessary to take on executive responsibilities. And now he is, as I say, he's a name in his own right. and the work that he wasn't the first course that he designed. Wasn't that in Wisconsin?
Yes, it was Sam. He I'd say co-designed it with I'm drawing a blank.
Well, David Kidd, I know, was involved in the second course.
Yeah, he did the second. So Kirk Crenshaw did the first course, and Michael worked with them, with both of them, in developing those sites into some two pretty darn good golf courses. And that, they did that. Michael did that because he had had experience at Bandon Dunes. I forget which courses he participated in on the ground, but he had ground level experience going into his in charge role at Sand Valley, Wisconsin.
Now, you talked about Bill Corr and Ben Crenshaw, who have been your partners for many years. And I have to ask you, when the three of you are together, and with Mike and Chris, et cetera, when your team is meeting, and I don't want to limit it just to those five individuals, I know there are many more, but if I was to be a fly on the wall to watch you all interact and communicate with one another, like in any business operation, what would I learn about sales watching all of you, quote, non-traditional salespeople, when you're trying to get a project started or get a project to completion? How is there influencing and persuasion going on in those internal meetings?
Letting them know, just based on your own responses, that all ideas are welcome, that all ideas are not great, but the only way we can sample them is first to hear them, and second, to look for opportunities to test as many of them as we can. And in golf course development, it's fairly easy. Just about all of our meetings were outside, and usually specifically targeting one hole or one aspect of one hole, where one of the six of us would say, well, what if that were a little higher? And then Ben Crenshaw would say, no, I think it should be lower. And in many cases, Rob, we could watch the bulldozer come and make the bump bigger, or the bump smaller, or the bump larger, wider. So that was it's a good microcosm, because whenever possible, if you test ideas instead of just saying, I don't like it, much better to say, that's interesting, I think it has merit, let's at least test it to see. With a golf course, as long as you're okay in spending a lot of time on site, testing is pretty easy. You can do it in the sand. It's another good attribute about sand. It's very easily moved, unlike heavy dirt or rock. The worst is rock. Moving sand is pretty easy.
Well, it's interesting. It's interesting, Mike. You talked about actually going out on site and having those conversations and maybe even those small debates on site. It reminds me of an old Japanese term called Kaizen. And Kaizen is when a group of workers who might have totally different perspectives and experiences will meet on site to look at a project or a problem that they're experiencing on their assembly line, and they will recognize that we need to go see the problem rather than just sit in a boardroom and talk about the problem.
Very wise. That sounds very wise. I'm thinking of the fisheries people in Port Orford, just south of Bandon. I have been complaining for years about overfishing, and they've had meetings and meetings and meetings where various people would say, well, just fish less, and no one ever got to a concluding business plan until one day Jim Seeley, who worked for me, said, instead of our meeting inside, why don't we go out to where it used to be great fishing, and we'll all see what kind of fish we catch. So he got five or six fishermen to get in their boats and go out to this rocky outcropping and see if they could catch any fish, and of course they didn't catch a single fish, which galvanized them into communal action to limit fishing from then on, and the fish are now back. An environmental group called RARE, R-A-R-E, I can't tell you what it stands for, basically does the same thing around the world. They go into fished-out fisheries and convince the locals by taking them on site and showing them that they weren't, no one is catching fish. It's not just you. No one is catching fish. Galvanizes them to work together.
Very interesting. Well, taking that long walk with you, as I've mentioned already, reminds me that that's probably a good way for me to manage systems and organizations and how to lead people is even just getting the exercise and being out in the fresh air.
Yeah.
Is a great way to communicate. I have a great friend in the Portland community who's a leader of industry in Portland, and one time he and I had a meeting, and unbeknownst to me, when I showed up at his office, he had his tennis shoes on. He said, let's go take a walk, and we walked literally around downtown Portland, and that's how we talked about the issues that were important to us at that time.
Yeah.
And golf, maybe that's another reason why golf is such a great way to do business.
I think that's right.
So, Mike, I know it's speaking of your kids, I know your golf courses are kind of like your kids, but I'm going to ask you one of those questions that I'd be curious if there's an answer. If you could take a guest to just one of your courses so they could see the definitive Mike Kaiser course, which one would it be right now?
It would be Cabot Cliffs. For years, I didn't have a favorite, but Cabot Cliffs in Nova Scotia is my favorite now because it was a series of parcels that had to be bought by somebody, and my partner Ben Cowandour, as a Canadian, was able to buy enough parcels for us to have beautiful duneland, beautiful flatland, and beautiful cliffs. It's a great combination of holes that Bill Coore and Ben Crenshaw fashioned. With a lot of great work by Ben Cowandour just in buying what was ended up being 20 parcels to put together one exquisite golf course site.
Well, Mike, I'd like to wrap up our conversation with a couple of more questions, and this last one might be sensitive on the surface, but it's really not. And that is, I want to talk about rivals for just a moment. When you and I met, you had a particular well-known rival in the golf developing world. He had more courses than you, but yours always outranked his. Yours are always ranked higher. And, of course, I'm speaking about someone who's really no longer in that space anymore. At least I hope he's not. He should be doing other things. And that's President Donald Trump. And we won't talk necessarily about the politics of Donald Trump, because whatever side people are on, that's really neither here nor there for this conversation. But I want to get your view about rivals and how we should view them in business or in sports or even in politics. Do rivals make us better, or do they just aggravate us?
They should make you better. In the case of Trump, who has somewhat he has a larger number of golf courses that he owns. He defines golf as a luxury. So everything he does on his courses are luxury oriented. He builds waterfalls. It's definitely not walking only. You have special carts. It wouldn't surprise me that they have Rolls-Royce grills. He sees golf as a luxury thing that you aspire to, that one day you'll be well enough off, Mr. Businessman, to play golf. And he's welcome to that view, but it's sort of the opposite of my view, which is more Scottish and Irish, where the common man is the 90% of the golf played in Scotland, Ireland, and Band and Dunes. The fact that it's walking only would be the opposite of luxury in that one rival's point of view. Fortunately for me, he's not the only rival, and he's in a different space, as I said, he's in the luxury space than I am. I think of my friendly competitors, Pebble Beach, who I very much admire, and Pinehurst as my two major competitors, and an example of how we help each other as healthy competitors. I visited Pinehurst number 2 after Bill Coore and Ben Crenshaw, who I raved about for getting the job, and he redid Pinehurst number 2, which is their gem, one of the top 10 in the world. And we wanted to go see it, so we did, and we were shown around by the general manager, and we were very impressed by what Bill and Ben had done in renovating the course. And the general manager, Don Padgett, said, if you like what they've done with the 18-hole course, you should see what they've done with the putting green. We just built this fabulous putting green by Bill and Ben. And I want to tell you, you should have one at Bandon Dunes. It's the most popular thing we have here. People come from 4 p.m. until 10 p.m. and play our par 3, the name of which eludes me right now. So here's a friendly competitor showing me the new thing that really works. And we, of course, went right back to Bandon and built a putting green, and it's been just as Don Padgett said, a huge success. So two kinds of competitors, one that belittle you and the other that wants you to succeed for the greater good.
That's a wonderful story. Well, I know that, speaking of Mr. Trump, I know he likes polls, and I know that you like rankings because your golf courses are always at the top of the rankings around the world. So certainly in sales and in business, numbers matter. You know, the numbers don't lie, as they say. So they have to be important to successful people. So how does that relate to those of us trying to get to the top of our field? Should we be concerned with our rankings, so to speak, within an office or within an industry? How should that drive us?
Yeah, I think it's competitive feedback with the sole goal of getting better. So if you are numbers or ranking oriented, it should be not just to be able to boast that I'm number one or I'm moving up to number three or four. It's to learn what things work for others as well as yourself and watch them move you up or down depending on your sales success. When you think of what you're selling as a finite thing, that's the wrong way to think about it. What we're selling is a constantly evolving set of circumstances or architectures or buildings or whatever it is. We're always looking to improve it, and that's the value of rankings. If you keep getting better, the rankings will show it, as well as your revenue.
Well, Mike, one of the culminating facts that comes to your course is whenever you get to host a world-class event such as this summer, I have to ask you as we wrap up, is Bandon Dunes still slated to host the U.S. Amateur Championship in August?
Yes, August 10th. In that area, it's a week-long event, and the USGA decided a month and a half ago that they would have the U.S. Open men's and women's, and the U.S. amateur men's and women's, those four tournaments versus 13, which they initially thought they'd do. So, yes, we will be hosting the U.S. amateur men's division in early August. And I'm very excited to be hosting what has always been a major.
Absolutely. Now, the COVID-19 has hurt a lot of businesses. I know that it has hurt yours in some respects. At least your courses probably have not been as full. And my last question is, how did you deal with that disruption? What's been your attitude throughout?
My first thought was, let's make sure that we keep employees employed even though we were shut for 6 weeks. So I'm proud of the fact that we employed 50% of our employees, and we furloughed the other 50%, which in the case of a furlough, you're still an employee, you're just paid by the unemployment compensation. And fortunately for us, the closure was only 6 weeks. We've come back strong. It won't be quite as good as last year, but pretty darn close. And a big reason for that is all of our employees came back, I would say in just about all cases, joyfully, much like your example of the young man who was driving the bus.
Well, Mike, I don't know if you're a businessman first who loves golf or if you're a golfer who just loves to be successful at business. I don't know how to describe you. Which one is it?
I'd say it's the avid golfer. And once an avid golfer, always an avid golfer. And most of them aren't really in business. And I'm in that big group. In that big group, certainly I'm avid. I'll go anywhere to play golf. Tasmania,
well,
New Zealand, St. Lucia, well, which is where we're building one right now.
So, I was going to say, you'll go anywhere to build golf.
They're great sites still all over the world, Rob.
Well, Mike, I sure appreciate the time you spent with me and our listeners, and appreciate, as always, your wisdom, and to share with us the insights as to what has made you so successful and so influential in this industry, and to provide all of us a venue all over the world, various venues, where we can do business, where we can live these principles with clients and prospects and employees and coworkers, et cetera. So thank you for making that happen. And I want to thank you for your friendship. It means a great deal to me.
It's always fun, Rob. Good to hear from you. And we will see each other again and again.
Yes, we will. All right. Thank you, Mike.
Good. Thanks, Rob.
Thanks for being a part of this episode of Game Face Execs. If you found any of it useful or helpful, please rate or like and subscribe to our YouTube channel. I always appreciate you referring us to others as well. I'll see you next week. Until then, persuade, influence, inspire.